coming up on this week's mini episode of the Drew Perowit Podcast.
Neurodegenerative conditions like Alzheimer's can also be highly inflammatory. So if you've got a glucose abnormality, excess insulin, and inflammation is turned up, you're really setting up the matrix for Alzheimer's to basically take place.
Hi, everyone. I know I'm not the only one who finds sleep a little tougher in the summer. Most people don't realize that temperature has a huge impact on how well we all sleep. One study, get this, found that of 765,000 people, it found that most people have abnormal sleeping patterns during the hotter summer months because it's difficult to keep an optimal temperature in their bedroom. And the other studies showed that we sleep deeper at cooler temperatures. While I try to keep a comfortable sleep environment all year long, now that summer's here, I'm extra mindful about keeping it cool. This goes way beyond cranking up the AC. It's important to keep your bed and body from overheating to truly optimize your sleep. I tried some of the bamboo sheets from Cozy Earth, which are natural temperature regulating, and I love how cool and comfortable they keep my bed. Most people have no clue that cotton is not the ideal option for temperature regulation. It was actually used as insulation back in the early 1900s and has been used for bedding even longer. It became a commonplace even though there are much better alternatives like bamboo. With bamboo sheets from Cozy Earth, my bed stays just the right temperature, even when it's hot here in LA or wherever it is that you live. Plus, they use a special weave that makes them softer than any other brands I've tried. I also love that I can trust Cozy Earth because their entire line is free from harmful chemicals that are found in most traditional beddings. Right now, Cozy Earth is offering my audience 40% off site-wide. This is the best discount they offer anywhere. Just head over to CozyEarth.com and use the discount code Drew, spelled differently, D-H-R-U, 40, Drew 40. That's Cozy, C-O-Z-Y, Earth, EARTH.com, and use the code DHRU40. I definitely recommend checking out their super comfortable bamboo sheets so you can get better sleep today. So the other day, I was with a doctor who specializes in environmental toxins, and they told me that the most toxic item in our home is actually our mattress. I'm sure many of you were shocked to hear that, as I was. This is especially scary when the average person spends more than 26 years of their life sleeping. We spend so much time in bed, but it's crazy that we're more likely to splurge on an expensive car or clothes. Well, I'm advocating for a better mattress for you. Most mattresses on the market, though, contain harmful chemicals and polyurethane foam, which emits things like volatile organic compounds or VOCs. They've been linked to respiratory issues, reproductive damage, and they can even damage your immunity. I spent a lot of time, looking for the perfect organic mattress, and I was so happy to find the Birch Mattress by Helix. The Birch is made right here in the US out of four non-toxic natural materials: organic latex, organic cotton, New Zealand wool, and American steel springs. It feels so great to know that I'm sleeping on a mattress that uses 0000 polyurethane-based foams. That means no off-gassing. Have you ever got a new mattress and you open it up and it smells like crap? That's called off-gassing. The Birch mattress doesn't do that. So now I can sleep a lot better knowing that I'm not exposing myself to harmful chemicals day in and day out. And the best part is, this mattress is crazy comfortable. You don't have to give up comfort when you choose the non-toxic option. I've honestly never slept better. So if you're looking for a new mattress, I highly recommend checking out the Birch. Right now, they're giving my community $200 off all mattresses plus two Eco Reset pillows. Just head over to birchliving.com/Drew. Again, that's $200 off and two free Eco Reset pillows at Birch, B-I-R-C-H, living, L-I-V-I-N-G.com/Drew, spelled differently, D-H-R-U. If you're worried about trying a new mattress, by the way, they have a 25-year warranty and you can try it risk-free for 100 nights. Birch also ships directly to your door for free with no contact required, and they'll pick it up for free if you don't love it. Check out the Birch mattress today by Helix. Hi, everyone. Drew Perrot here. Around the world, we struggle with diseases that were once considered super rare. Cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's disease, and diabetes affect millions of people every single year. Many people are also struggling with hypertension, weight gain, fatty liver, low testosterone, menstrual irregularities, and infertility. We treat these symptoms, not realizing that all these diseases, symptoms, and conditions have something in common. Each of them is caused or made worse by a condition known as insulin resistance, and over half of just the United States is insulin resistant, with most of the other countries around the world either worse or not far behind. In this mini episode, I speak with my dear friends, Dr. Ronesh Sinha and Dr. Ben Bickman, about why insulin resistance has become so prevalent, what makes us insulin resistant in the first place, and how to reverse and prevent insulin resistance through specific dietary and lifestyle modifications. Let's start with Dr. Ronesh Sinha, an internal medicine physician who has designed health, education, and wellness programs for over 20 major Silicon Valley companies, launched a medical mobile clinic providing primary care to busy employees, and developed a dedicated practice geared to South Asians and Asians with insulin resistance and related conditions. He's also the author of the South Asian Health Solution, Insulin Resistance. Tell us a little bit more about it and why it's so crucial when it comes to our health.
So insulin resistance is a very complex topic, and this is one of the most critical concepts I think doctors and patients need to understand in a way that's really simple so they can apply their daily lifestyle to it. And I think the way I'd want to start off with it to really keep it simple is when we consume carbohydrates, our body breaks it down into glucose. And one of the most compelling images I use in talks and in my book is I tell people, think of that glucose molecule as being a car, and you've got three parking lots in your body. There's more than three parking lots, but the three major ones are your muscle lot, your liver lot, and your fat parking lot. And in an ideal situation, especially after meals, we want that glucose car to roll into your muscle lot so your muscle can burn that for fuel, for energy. And the way that car gets inside that muscle is by using the hormone insulin. So that's kind of like the parking pass that gets the car through the door. So literally when we're saying you've become insulin resistant, what's happening is your muscle is no longer responding to that signal properly. So now we've got this overflow glucose traffic. Some of it's maybe sneaking inside, but what do we do with that glucose traffic now that it can't get into our ideal destination? And that's where that overflow traffic can go in various directions. It can go towards our fat cells and it can be turned into fat. It can inflate our fat cells, and that's where we get obesity. It can go to our liver, and the liver can basically store it as glycogen, or it can actually turn the excess amounts into fat, which is why we're seeing an epidemic of fatty liver. And then the liver can expel that as triglyceride particles and cholesterol. So you can see that just from that, what I call a glucose traffic problem, you can get all these downstream metabolic manifestations that can present at any age. So I'd say at a high level, that's how I look at insulin resistance. But when you dig deeper, you realize there's a lot of complexity, and we can unravel that as we go along with this interview.
And just make the link from insulin sensitivity to insulin resistance to like full-blown diseases that we all know that are out there that have names that we would recognize.
Good point. So when you are insulin sensitive in an ideal situation, if we sat down and had a breakfast with some carbohydrates in it, then our muscles would be acutely sensitive to that insulin parking pass. So a good amount of the glucose, and actually in an ideal situation, about 80% of our glucose after a meal would go into the muscle, and some of that would be stored in the glucose parking lot, and some of it would be burned for energy. As we slowly become insulin resistant, what's happening is we're losing that ability. So the muscle is becoming less responsive to that insulin parking pass. And as a result of that, the glucose will gradually start to elevate. And even before the glucose elevates, you can see other changes. So let's back up before glucose issues. Sometimes what happens is with that parking problem, you might already start seeing changes in your body habitus. So you might be gaining a little bit of extra inches around the stomach. You might see some subtle changes in your liver panel or your cholesterol panel, because some of those changes might precede the glucose abnormalities by 8 to 10 years. And this is a key point that I really try to train my my patients and physician colleagues on is do not wait for the glucose to go up to identify insulin resistance. Look down at your waistline, start looking at your lipid panel early on and look at your triglycerides, your HDL. We'll dig more deeper into that, but look for those precursors. And if you want to back up even further behind that, is look at your family history. Like, are there individual family members that have insulin resistance? Did your mom have gestational diabetes when she was pregnant? These are sort of the early things that you can look at. Now, one of the things that happens early on in life is even when our muscles are becoming a little bit insulin resistant, our body responds in a specific way to keep the glucose down. And what it does is your pancreas actually produces extra amounts of insulin. So it's like your body's producing more of that insulin parking pass, and that can overcome that early insulin resistance. So it can keep your glucose levels in good shape. But over time, think of your beta cells in the pancreas, which produce the insulin, as being a battery pack. You don't want to wear that battery out early. So if that pancreas is happening to work over time that beta cell is going to start to burn out. And now it can't produce enough insulin to push that glucose into that muscle parking lot. So that's sort of the spectrum of starting off with insulin sensitivity, then early stage insulin resistance that can precede glucose abnormalities by 10, 15 plus years. And then if we don't intervene at that point, the pancreas starts to burn out the beta cells and we start seeing glucose going into pre-diabetes, diabetes zones. So that's sort of the spectrum.
And not just pre-diabetes and diabetes zones, you wrote this incredible article talking about Alzheimer's, right? So yeah. Tell us about the link with insulin resistance and what we know so far when it comes to something like Alzheimer's and brain health.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, this connection is one of the most compelling things when I sit down with my patients in the clinic, and I practice in Silicon Valley. So I see a lot of people with very strong brain power, and a lot of them are desensitized about the heart, I feel like. But when they hear about the link between insulin resistance and Alzheimer's disease and neurodegenerative disease, that really gets their attention. And really what's happening is when you've got that glucose abnormality and you're changing the fuel systems in the body, you're actually causing a lot of things to happen. So the glucose elevations themselves can have a degenerative effect on the brain. But that hyperinsulinemia, when we're overproducing insulin, that excess amount of insulin, so we need insulin to survive, but it's like anything else in the body. When you have too much of a good thing, it becomes bad. So when you have excessive amounts of insulin, it can actually prevent your brain from actually clearing amyloid, which is one of the damaging substances that accumulates and causes, you know, Alzheimer's.
So, many listeners of this podcast know about amyloid plaque from different people that are here. So the link that you're making is that this traffic jam of glucose makes it tougher to clear the amyloid plaque in the brain.
Exactly.
And how does that happen?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, basically with hyperinsulinemia, so there are enzymes basically on a daily basis that can actually help degrade and clear amyloid. But when insulin is actually elevated, it interrupts those enzymes from that clearing process. So that's one of the ways that actually ends up working. And then, like I said, the combined, you know, the other issue is we should also, as much as I kind of disconnect insulin resistance from the process of inflammation, and I think you've spoken very eloquently about inflammation in other shows, but insulin resistance is intrinsically an inflammatory condition. So your body's inflammation levels are revved up. And as we know, neurodegenerative conditions like Alzheimer's can also be highly inflammatory. So if you've got a glucose abnormality, excess insulin, and inflammation is turned up, you're really setting up the matrix for Alzheimer's to basically take place. And that's why we're seeing like a 50% increase in type 2 diabetics of Alzheimer's disease. So it's something we got to take very seriously early on.
We've had Dr. David Perlmutter on the podcast, and he echoed an important point that you have made in that article and in other places and podcasts. He said, you know, if you want to think about reducing your risk of Alzheimer's, look at what your lifestyle looks like today. Yeah. And you put out a term that I actually really loved. And, you know, so much of public health and getting people excited is using the right language.
Sure.
And you put out a term that obviously makes sense, but I had not had clicked before, which is pre-Alzheimer's, just like we think of like pre-diabetes.
Yes.
Which is you are on the verge of becoming a diabetic or having type 2 diabetes. You put out a term called pre-Alzheimer's, and you were putting in kind of quotes. It's not a medical term.
Right.
Yet, maybe one day.
Maybe, who knows, yeah.
So for those listeners that are interested today, if they wanted to look at their lifestyle now and their labs, and if they wanted to understand if they're in that range of pre-Alzheimer's, in quotes, what would they be looking for?
So I would say from a very simplistic level, again, if we focus on that insulin resistant process, you would look at the same factors that I look at when I'm evaluating risk factors for diabetes or heart disease. So basically insulin resistant parameters would be looking at your lipids in a little bit of a different way than a lot of doctors would. It's a focus on the triglycerides. It's a focus on the HDL, which we call the healthy cholesterol. So typically if the triglycerides are high and your healthy cholesterol levels are low, that could be a sign of early insulin resistance. If your liver function tests are up, that could be a sign that a lot of traffic is basically going towards the liver. If your inflammation levels are up, so, you know, as part of my sort of metabolic six pack, I've added the HSC reactive protein as being a really important marker. Now, I do want to put a disclaimer in that a lot of people feel like when their CRP test comes back normal, they feel like they're out of the woods, but it's not a definitive marker for all types of systemic inflammation. So you can have a completely normal C-reactive protein, but still have low brewing sort of insidious inflammation happening. I'd start with those. And then body metrics wise is paying attention to your waist circumference. So at a high level, you know, I tend to focus on labs that anybody in a traditional healthcare system can get, but definitely beyond that, from the exciting work that Dr. Bredesen and others are doing, there's toxicology screens, you can do ApoE testing, you can definitely take it a further level, which I know Dr. Perlmutter would be more of an expert at discussing those, but starting with these first level, first order tests, you can already identify a lot of risks in the general population.
My next guest, Dr. Ben Bickman, is a renowned metabolic research scientist and a popular speaker on human metabolism and nutrition. He's the author of Why We Get Sick, which offers thought-provoking yet real solutions to insulin resistance and how to reverse prediabetes, improve brain function, shed fat, and even prevent diabetes itself. Dr. Bickman and I discussed four steps you can take today to improve your insulin resistance. Let's listen in. Okay, now what? If somebody finds themselves in that boat where they're either well on their way to being pre-diabetic or they are pre-diabetic, which I think the numbers in the US are 80 million people are in pre-diabetic or have pre-diabetes, what do they do now in terms of the interventions? So we know food plays a major role in this process, and you've already hinted towards the fact that we want to get away from this high carbohydrate food, classic 1960s, 70s food pyramid in the United States. We want to get away from that type of diet. And what do we want to move closer towards?
Yeah. So I would say to effectively treat this ubiquitous problem, we can focus on two aspects of health. And I'll elaborate, I'll dive into each of these in a little more detail. One is lower insulin by dietary changes. And two, it is lower stress. Now, let's start with number two, just because it's a simpler concept that I won't have to elaborate as much on. But with lower stress, I mean, change your external environment and your habits in such a way to help your stress hormones, namely cortisol and adrenaline, to come down. And the single most effective way to do that is better sleep habits. Now, that is the topic that few people enjoy hearing about, because and I'm one of them. I'm a terrible sleeper. I just have a hard time staying asleep because my mind just starts racing. So I get it. But that is probably, in most people, the single greatest stressor and resulting in high cortisol levels and adrenaline, or also called epinephrine. As those two stress hormones are up, they directly antagonize what insulin tries to do, making the body insulin resistant very rapidly. Even one bad night of sleep can cause demonstrable insulin resistance the next day.
Now, which leads to leads to overeating the next day as well.
Oh yeah, that's right. You feel miserable. You have this sort of almost this desire just to kind of abuse your body. You're angry and you just want something to kind of help you feel a little better. Well, it's going to be some junk food of some kind or some sugary loaded alcohol. So lower the stress by improving sleep habits. I'll just kind of leave it there because there's a lot that would go into that. And then lowering insulin, I think, is the single most important variable. And that does mean altering the diet. And to me, there are four pillars, you know, four legs that this table is built on. First of all, control carbohydrates. That is the low-hanging fruit. That ought to be step number one. Change the diet around to eliminate processed starches and sugars and focus on more whole, like truly whole carbohydrates, namely fruits and vegetables. Let most of your carbohydrates, if not all of them, come from fruits and vegetables. Very much scrutinize the grains like rice and wheat and corn. Focus on fruits and vegetables and eat them, don't drink them. If someone is just eating fruits and vegetables, they're going to be doing it the right way. So first step, control your carbohydrates. That is the food that spikes insulin really the most. It's really the only one. And then two, prioritize protein. Make sure that as you are restricting the carbohydrates, focus on high quality proteins. And Drew, it's not a popular sentiment to elaborate on that, but I'm gonna. That is, focus on animal protein. This whole explosion of plant protein is, I don't know how else to say it, just a marketing gimmick. In every way, plant protein is inferior to animal protein. It doesn't have the kind of full complement and mix of amino acids, mitigating the benefit of that plant protein. It also, every plant protein has things in it called anti-nutrients, actual molecules that inhibit our ability to digest the protein. So we're not only getting not a great mix of protein and the amino acids, but we can't even get the ones we're eating because there are things like phytic acids, tannins, trypsin inhibitors in all of these proteins, like soy protein, pea protein. It doesn't matter. Every one of them has these anti-nutrients that block some of our ability to digest. And then one last point, these plant proteins also have high levels of heavy metals. This has been revealed through an independent group called the Clean Label Project, and they found that plant proteins were the highest offenders, having potentially toxic levels of lead and arsenic. And that's because plants naturally get enriched to some degree with minerals, with metals from the soil. That's a natural process. But we have made it unnatural by trying to get protein from something we shouldn't get protein from. Like, for example, peas. If we want to get a serving of protein from peas, we need like 1,000 peas, because peas are so deficient in protein naturally. We've got to concentrate all of those amino acids to get a serving of protein. That's what we want. That's the desired outcome. The inadvertent outcome also, as we're concentrating all that stuff from the peas, is we get too much of the metals that are naturally growing into peas. Now, if someone just eats some peas, the amount of mineral they're getting is inconsequential. It's insignificant. It's nothing. It's only when we've now artificially concentrated them, now we're getting potentially dangerous levels of these metals. So prioritize protein, make sure you're getting enough protein. And that's the best sources, demonstrably, are whey and egg whites, but just eggs, I would say, and then any kind of meat as well. So those are the proteins that someone should focus on. And then step number three is fill all remaining calories with fat. The power of dietary fat is that fat has no effect on insulin. Protein has a modest effect on its own, but fat has no effect. And in nature, those best protein sources that I just mentioned come with fat. It is a fact of nature. The best proteins come with fat, and that is that's a synergistic mix where fat helps the body digest and use protein better. Fat and protein is healthier and more anabolic than protein alone. So all these efforts of people to get like a protein shake and it's just like pure whey, that's unnatural. We're not meant to eat just protein without the fat. So let the fat be a natural part of the diet. And to points we made earlier, focus on animal fats and fruit fats. And the fruit fats are generally coconuts and olives and avocados. So the difference with those fats is our ancestors simply need, and even now, you just take the flesh of that fruit, not the seed, not the pit, but the flesh of it, and just squish it. You compress it, and now you have the oil. Even it requires as little force as just our own body. You know, we could just physically be stepping on the coconut or the olives, and we're getting that oil. We as a species have been eating those fats, animal fats and fruit fats, since time immemorial. We are well adapted to those. Avoid scrupulously these industrial seed oils like soybean oil, cottonseed, canola, etc. And that matters because at least in the U.S., and it's most certainly the same in other countries, it's just not as well measured, soybean oil is the single most commonly consumed fat in the American diet. So someone listening to this would think, well, I don't need soybean oil. Yeah, you do. If you're eating a processed, a packaged food, it is very, very likely the fat in it is going to be from something like soybean oil, if not soybean oil itself. So fill with fat. That's rule number three, but focus on animal and fruit fats. And then the fourth pillar is watch the clock. Don't feel the need to eat all the time. So engage in this idea of time-restricted eating or intermittent fasting. You know, give yourself an eating window, you know, where you have eating, you know, you're fasting for 20 hours in the day and you eat during the four, whatever. Let your body take a break from eating to help insulin stay low. And when it's time to eat, eat. And eat as much as you feel like you need to. Don't worry about the calories. That's not what that idea is based on. But just engage in some form of intermittent fasting.
Yeah, and the one caveat that I want to include inside of there, and obviously, you know, you're deep in this space, is that there does seem to be some difference between a little bit men and women. Not that women can't enjoy the benefits of the fasting, but women with their infradian rhythm, especially in a childbearing age, and again, this is where it's like about paying attention to your body, they may not benefit the same exact extreme fast that men benefit from. So, you know, obviously figuring that out, dialing that in, we've done a couple episodes on the topic that we'll link to in the show notes. But in general, obviously everybody recommends fasting. Just tweak it to, you know, your body and, you know, who you are.
Well said. Yep. Well said. So anyway, those are the four pillars. So to kind of sum it all up, the best ways to improve insulin resistance, which is very improvable. That is very much something we can start to change within a day. You can start to improve your insulin resistance. It is lower stress, most especially through better sleep habits, and then lower the insulin through, you know, at least the four recommendations that I just outlined.
Yeah, fantastic. Do you want to give so many people are talking about movement, but do you want to just give a quick reminder of why movement is so important when mm-hmm. it comes to insulin?
Yeah. Yeah. So you'd mentioned already one of the most relevant variables there, which is muscle is the main consumer of glucose. So let's let the muscle eat that glucose. Even in someone who's insulin resistant and insulin wasn't working as well at the muscle, the power or the beauty of the muscle is that it has an insulin independent channel or back door to pull in glucose. So if a muscle starts to contract, we start to work that muscle in that dynamic rhythm of contract and relax, it starts to do what insulin would do. So even though the muscle is resistant to insulin, we enable the muscle to start pulling in glucose on its own without the need of insulin. And thus, of course, if we're lowering glucose, we lower insulin better. And indeed, during the course of an exercise session, insulin comes down and there is a demonstrable improvement in insulin sensitivity during and following the exercise. And then importantly, Drew, I would encourage people, don't finish your exercise with a carbohydrate-rich meal. There's a study in humans to show that if someone exercises, the insulin sensitizing benefits even continue to the next day. But if at the end of that exercise session, they eat a load of carbohydrates, they undo that insulin sensitizing effect of the exercise. So very commonly, people will finish their exercise and they'll think, oh, well, now I'm going to indulge. I'm going to eat this fruit smoothie or this, you know, starchy cereal or bread or whatever. No, don't. You're undoing much of the benefit of the exercise.
The good news is that insulin resistance usually can be quickly reversed or eliminated by change in diet and lifestyle. As our guest shared today, regular exercise, a diet high in protein, healthy fats, and insulin-friendly fruits and vegetables can produce almost immediate results, and often these interventions work even better than drugs that are out there. It just takes some intention and focus and education. I hope this podcast today and our guest, Dr. Ben Bickman and Dr. Ronesh Sinha, have provided that education and that inspiration for you. Remember, you're always the CEO of your own health. Make sure you drive it and surround yourself with the right team. I hope you've enjoyed this mini episode of the Drew Proit podcast. If you did, share it with a friend. Share it with a friend. It could make their day. I'll see you next week.